I'm AJ Bianco from Podcast PD, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like this show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual host. Make sure you check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And get ready, because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, welcome back. Today I'm talking with Dr. Megan Roberts. She's the executive director of Math for America, based in Manhattan, New York City. That's right, and we're talking all about Math for America. This is from their mission statement on their website. Math for America is focused on changing the way we think about teachers and teaching in America. You're going to love this one. It's going to get you fired up. You're going to have such positive energy. You're going to want to get right back in that classroom and start making a difference. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
All right, today we're going to talk about Math for America, and I want to read this from their website. Our model is simple. We don't fix teachers. We don't reform their practice. Instead, we focus on excellence and trust. We find the best teachers across New York City and build a professional community for them to collaborate and learn from one another. Ultimately, we inspire them to stay in the classroom and amplify their impact across the city and beyond. MFA is focused on changing the way we think about teachers and teaching in America. Their goal is to improve retention nationally by establishing a network of independent programs modeled on Math for America that supports communities of accomplished mathematics and science teachers across the country. And today I'm talking with Megan Roberts, who is the executive director of Math for America. Prior to joining MFA, Megan served for 4 years as executive director for the Office of Innovation within the New York City Department of Education. She also spent 16 years working in the New York City public school system, where she began her career as a science teacher in Manhattan. She then became a middle school principal and then the regional director for STEM. She is a past Woodrow Wilson Science Teaching Fellow, a Fulbright Memorial Teaching Fellow, and a Columbia University Science Teacher Research Fellow, for which she now serves on the advisory board. She's on the board of directors for the National Science and Technology Medals Foundation, and is a mentor for the Deeper Learning Equity Fellows, a national group of emerging leaders in addressing issues of educational inequity. Megan has published articles and presented nationally and internationally on topics in geosciences, science education, professional development, educational technology, and innovation in education. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband, 2 children, and adorable puppy. Megan, thanks for joining me today. Say hi to everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Hi, Steve. Happy to be here.
We appreciate you joining us, and look forward to hearing more about Math for America. And but before we do that, and by the way, is the puppy really adorable?
It's so funny. I just smirked when I heard you say that. He is so adorable. My husband and I like to joke that sometimes we like him best. He is a 7-month golden retriever, and everybody should have the pleasure of having a golden retriever puppy in their home.
Very nice. Very nice. The we had. When I was a small kid, I had there's pictures of me with our golden retriever, and very friendly. But depending on how small your kids are, they could grow to be a little bigger.
Yeah, no, I have a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old, and we said that we were only going to get a dog when our children were old enough to walk him or her by themselves. So my son is very much in the circuit of responsibility.
Excellent. Well, before we get into Math for America, you have amazing credentials, and you started out as a science teacher and taught for 16 years. What do you like most about teaching?
So funny. I'm so glad you asked that when I saw that question. I wish more people would ask that question. It's the fondest memories I have as an educator of being a teacher. My background was in structural geology. My undergraduate degree was not in teaching, and it was not in education. It was in a hard science. Though I would argue that the physicists would say that structural geology is not a hard science, but that's probably another podcast for another time. But I think the thing that I loved most about teaching, and I think you hear teachers say this all the time, but I don't say it to be trite or to be cheeky, but it was the kids. But in the context of this conversation, I would say what I liked the most about it, I was a young teacher when I began, and I think that I knew my content well, and I had sort of armed myself with skills of pedagogy, but I think you don't get to actualize what it means to be a teacher until you are in a room of students or in the lives of students. And I spent many years learning how to teach from them. As much as I was their teacher, they were certainly mine. And so when I look back on those years of teaching, what I remember aren't the lessons that I taught. They aren't the units that I taught. It was the kids who I taught. And many of them, you know, not to age myself, but many of them are just full-fledged professional adults these days. And I know many of them. And so I think that to me is my legacy of teaching is the kids.
That's awesome. And I got to tell you, I agree with you that that's I got into teaching because I wanted to make history fun. I was a history teacher and I wanted to make it interesting and fun because my experience was the opposite and history had so much to offer. And then I became a teacher and found out there's so much more that our role is beyond the content, from counselor to, you know, just any number of things. But the and I still like I so agree with you, this that role of working with the kids and those memories are so there. And it's funny when you run into them because mine the same way. I just ran into one the other day who he told me that this weekend was his 40th birthday. And I went, okay.
Yeah, I know. And then you're trying to mask. I don't know about you, but then I sort of flip my hair the other way so you can't see the gray hair when I see those people. Because it's true. They keep getting older, but I keep telling myself I'm not, but I think I'm kidding myself.
See, that's it exactly. You just have to move.
Just keep moving around the country.
Exactly.
Or coloring your hair, whatever works.
Whatever works. I like that.
Yeah.
So awesome answer. So, you know, and that's what it's all about is the kids. So what I'd like to do is, what do you think are some of the reasons that teachers quit or leave teaching?
You know, I mean, I think there's lots of reasons. I think there's a lot of research on that. There's a lot of literature. It's certainly in the world right now in education that we talk a lot about the why teachers leave. It's very topical now. I'm sure you read the Time magazine covers a couple weeks ago, and there's lots of people talking about it. But I think for me, when I think about why teachers leave, it goes in sort of two very broad buckets. One is they're recognized very early for their greatness or their high accomplishments. And because of our shortage of teachers across the country, or maybe not even shortage, because in different places, shortages aren't as prevalent. But I think either they find success very early and they've been taught and trained that success means they need to move on to something else. And so they do. So you have lots of teachers who are fantastic teachers early on who maybe haven't mastered their craft, but have become very early on show great signs of success. And so they're asked to and incentivized to become assistant principals or coaches or staff developers or leave the school environment and work for educational organizations that are supporting teachers. So one path, I think, is teachers leave because we live in a world where it's not incentivized to stay if you're really good at what you do. And that happened to me, you know, like I became an AP or assistant principal is the New York language. I think your listeners might know it as VP or, you know, in lots of different places, it's vice principal. But, you know, we're incentivized to do what's next. You know, there's this mindset, there's a ladder out of the classroom if you're really good at what you do, instead of the ladder helping teachers figure out how to be leaders from within. We have this way of believing about the profession that if you're great, you leave. And so I think a lot of teachers do that. On the other side, I think teachers leave the classroom or quit, I think is your word, because they're just frustrated. They're frustrated because they're isolated. They're frustrated perhaps because they're not resourced well enough. And I mean that both for their own paycheck as well as what their classrooms need for their kids from a resource perspective. They don't feel like they get support. They don't feel respected. They don't feel like they have people with whom they can be mentor or collaborate. They don't feel like they're in a community. And it's a really lonely profession if that's the kind of environment that you're in. So I think, you know, and within each of those broad categories, either you're too great to stay or you're too frustrated to stay. I think there's lots of other reasons that are within those. You know, I think that people leave for more money. People leave because it's too hard. People leave because they never plan to stay a long time. But to me, it boils down to those two broad categories.
And I like that you get focused on those two categories, because those are two things that we do reward the idea that you get successful. So what's the next thing? And and that one of the most fantastic teachers I've ever worked with, in a school where we were trying to get all kinds of problematic community issues under control, and the kids just loved this teacher, and she was so dynamic and just able to do so many different things. And the system hired her way to do online stuff because she's also a good technology person. It's like, oh, no, you're killing me.
I think places like New York City are similar to sort of large urban sectors or large urban districts. California, Texas, New York, lots of big states have different issues. So, you know, in some of the more suburban areas of the country, there's not as much opportunity to move about the district, right? The woman you just spoke about might have worked in a district where there's opportunities to, quote unquote, be promoted. But I think urban sectors have it even, it's more egregious. So in New York City, there's 1.1 million kids, which is just staggering, right?
Yes.
Keep in mind around that number. We have 1,700 schools in our district. So we're sort of an economy unto ourselves, right? We're the largest school district in the country. Our students speak 196 languages. English is the second language here. Spanish is the majority language spoken in New York City. And so you can just imagine, I mean, we can imagine a lot of things, but for the purposes of this conversation, there's the amount of teachers in New York City is a huge number. But more than that, the amount of other types of educational jobs within the system. There's like 85,000 educators who don't even work in schools, but who work on behalf of schools, everything from coaches to assistant principals to mentor, all sorts of opportunities. And so there's so much opportunity for teachers to find something else and stay in the district, or to your point, be incentivized to do something else in the district. And that doesn't happen as much in small school districts where there's not such a gargantuan system with as many sort of FTE personnel. So we struggle with that in New York. There's so many opportunities for teachers who don't have to leave our system. And I could say system in lots of ways, but for this conversation, I would say who don't have to leave their union, who don't have to think about switching their healthcare, who don't have to think about switching anything other than where they work because it's all the same district. But the opportunities are really endless.
That's wild. The numbers, like you said, are staggering because I've worked in some big systems in the metro Atlanta area and of Georgia. And but they're nowhere in comparison to the numbers you're talking about, even though they are very large for the state and the South and many states across the nation, but not yours.
Yeah, no, I know. And California and Texas, California is the second to New York, but the difference with the California numbers is that there's many districts and you still have to, geography is more spread out. So you still don't think about movement or shuffling as much because it still requires changing the way you live your own life. But in New York City, it's very, our population is quite dense in a small geographic area. So you don't have to think about your outside life to change your professional life if you don't want to.
That's so wild because it in many of our areas in Georgia alone, you'd have to change districts in order to see some of those types of positions. There's some districts that, you know, have more opportunities than others, but you know, in many cases you'd have to make that decision to say, I'm going to try and go over to that place over there. Let's start talking about Math for America. What kind of, give us in a nutshell what Math for America does.
Yeah, it's hard to do in a nutshell, but I'll give it a shot. Okay. So at our heart, we're a fellowship model. So that's as succinct as I can be. We're quite different than when you think in your schema about what a fellowship model is. It might not be exactly what comes to mind. But what we do is we incentivize sort of the best science and math teachers, contrary to our name being Math for America. We also work with science teachers. And we provide a fellowship structure for them to work together and work collaboratively. So it's a model where we take teachers who have an enormous amount of experience. So you have to have at least 4 years under your belt to even apply for our fellowships. And once you're accepted, you sort of, our teachers like to say it's the keys to the Cadillac. Once you're accepted, you join this community of other teachers who take courses with each other, who teach courses to each other, who get access to some of the best mathematical and science minds across the country for a variety of different kinds of conversations and lectures and seminars and courses. And they do that in a community construct. So our fellowship model is one where, you know, I often say that we create a little bit of a mini university here, a semester-based university where our teachers each semester enroll in and then participate in and often lead courses for one another. And what's different about that than a lot of other PD or professional development ways of thinking is we don't decide, we don't have an agenda, we're not dogmatic, we don't have a way in which we ask anybody to think or a content in which we ask everyone to learn. We sort of come at it from a completely different perspective, which is we ask the teachers what they want to learn, and then they teach those things to one another. And so it's quite dynamic. It's quite broad. The scale is quite large. We have a little over 1,000 teachers in our fellowships. And just to give you a sense of perspective, there's about 10,000 science and math teachers in New York City. And about 1,000 of them are what we call MFA teachers. So it's about 10% of the city's teachers are in our fellowships. And then looking a little bit higher in the clouds, what we do is, what's our purpose? What's our goal? Is what we're really trying to do is both change the professional lives of these teachers, because as we talked about a few minutes ago, we want to incentivize them to stay in the classroom. And we think that the ways in which we can do that are to remove some of the barriers that we know why they leave. So going back to my original comments, we pay them. I think it's an important just to say that they receive a very generous stipend for their fellowship. And that dollar amount is somewhat, it's just about the differential between what an experienced teacher in New York City makes and what a first year assistant principal makes. It's $15,000 a year. So we provide a financial incentive for them to stay in the classroom. And then we also try to remove the barriers of isolation and lack of respect and lack of collaboration by providing an environment that's extraordinarily collaborative, extraordinarily respectful, and extraordinarily trusting and safe. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is both incentivize these 1,000 teachers to both want to stay in the classroom, as well as incentivize them and arm them with the right supports and ideas to support the next generation or another set of 10,000 teachers, whether those teachers are in their schools or in neighboring schools. We aspire to change the way teachers think about teaching. And ultimately, we mean not just our teachers, but the larger landscape of teachers in New York City and I would argue across the country.
That's awesome. And thank you. This is what I think is so unique about what you're talking about, because this is not just like any organization. And that's just sounds dumb what I just said, but it's because everything is unto itself. But it's lots of organizations have different goals and activities. What you guys are really doing, I mean, you're giving these stipends so that you can get them doing what you want them to do, which is to come in and learn a little bit about expressing yourself, finding out what it is you need to know and what you want to know, and helping them get to know that, and working in these communities to make the profession better, which means that the kids are going to end up getting a better experience in the classroom. And
that's right.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, it's a mindset though too, Steve. I mean, I think through all of that, these are sort of, you and I both have a pretty good idea of what that looks like, right? If I were to envision what you just described, if you were to envision what I just described, it's not hard to get your head around, okay, 20 really smart teachers in a room talking about X, Y, and Z together and then doing other things with it. But the mindset for us is not to be lost in this. And we spend an enormous amount of time and attention on trying to model how teachers collaborate in a peer environment, both with structures and formats and facilitation. And we try to model how to talk professionally about practice. We try to model how to always put student work at the forefront of what we're talking about. We try to model how we use this term deprivatize what we do in the classroom. We try to model how to lead peer conversations, how to facilitate adult learning. And we try to model always keeping the idea of trust and respect at the front of what we're talking about. So the actual constructs aren't hard to imagine, but the ways in which we sort of, with real emphasis, and I would say the only place we're dogmatic, is to model and incentivize the way that we talk to each other and the way that we talk about practice.
And I want to go back to something that you just said, because I thought it was so cool. You were talking about modeling where you're talking about modeling, one of the things you talked about is modeling how to talk to each other professionally. And I think that is such an incredible skill and something to take on, because you'll have from time to time that basically some of the most successful teachers often are not very good at talking with one another about what they do. And sometimes it's just a matter of whether we're not going to share because we're afraid someone's going to steal my stuff, or if it's just,
that's right,
we might get into arguments about it, or afraid of getting into arguments.
Instead,
avoid those types of conversations. I love the idea of getting them into the groups to show them and model to them how this conversation can happen and letting them go from there. That's cool.
Yeah. And giving them the tools to do it too. Right. I always say that, protocols are the tools that we need to use, although we wish we didn't need them. It helps us have the conversations that we wish we could have without them, right? I mean, I think that being a great teacher of students is not the same as being a great teacher of adults. I'm sure you know that as well. And so it's a different toolkit, you know?
Yes. There's so much inside of that right there that
we could talk
for a couple hours. That's awesome. One of the things is that, you know, like if someone goes to the Math for America website, they'll see this model there. And I just wonder if you could explain it just a little bit and how teachers, you know, how the teacher is involved in that aspect. I mean, and already you've kind of touched on a lot of it. And I just wondering if you could just kind of explain that a little bit more.
Sure. A little of the concreteness of it, you mean?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, sure. So I'll take you through it in 2 minutes and you can ask me if you want to elaborate on particular aspects.
That'll work.
So I'll skip the whole admissions process unless you want me to talk about the admissions process. We can go back to it.
Let's go ahead and if we can come back to that if we get a chance.
Okay. So imagine, if you will, 1,000 teachers. They are all across New York City. They're all public school teachers. They are all teachers of mathematics or one of the sciences. And I include computer science in that as well. And so I'm just going to do a quick stats for you just to help you frame it. So I would say about – I don't know if I'll have my percentages exactly right for today's purposes, but about 70% of our teachers teach in high school spaces, and the remainder teach in middle school spaces, and we have a small but robust cohort of elementary school teachers as well. So just to give you, we're talking a lot of sort of secondary type thinking. And so we put out a catalog every semester. You can actually see the catalog on our website if you like, but the way that catalog gets built, to your question, is by teachers. And so the timelines aren't exactly going to line up, but let's call it every semester, teachers respond to this call. And this call says to 1,000 teachers, hey, 1,000 teachers, we're building the catalog for next semester. We have three questions for you. One, question number one, what kinds of courses, what do you want to learn? What are the content areas or pedagogical areas, or just in general, what do you want to learn? So the teachers might say things like, you know, we're really interested in learning about, I'm interested in learning more about Delta Math. I'm interested in learning about, the mathematics of the Rubik's Cube. I'm really interested in learning about how the Common Core standards are rolling out. I'm really interested in learning about neurobiology, whatever it is. That's question number one. What do you want to learn? Question number two is, do you want to be the person to teach it? Meaning, like, do you feel like you have do you have that expertise? And sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes the answer is no. And then question three is, do you know someone else who can? Right? So these are sort of the three questions that we ask to 1,000 teachers. And then we get all those responses back. And I won't bore you with the sort of digital complications and all of the charts and LMSs that require that kind of data collection. But then what we do is we look for trends and we say, okay, there's a huge interest this semester in this content area or this educational area. You know, we've seen an uptick in the last couple of years of teachers wanting to learn about comp sci. We've seen an uptick in the last couple of years of teachers wanting to talk about race and equity in the classroom. We've seen an uptick in the last couple of years of lots of sort of advanced math topics that are going on. The argument about algebra across the country has become very topical for us. And then we also see an enormous amount of courses that teachers want that we know that happen all the time. They want to talk about, you know, advanced statistics. They want to talk about the economics of mathematics. They want to talk about the living environment, whatever it is. And then we sort of take all that data and we say, okay, these are the sort of nut of courses. We usually land on about 200 courses a semester. And then about half of those courses end up being taught by the teachers themselves. And we are, all of those courses that are taught by the teachers are all co-led by two teachers. We have a firm belief that co-facilitation is a really powerful model for peer learning. So the teachers are involved by deciding what courses we teach. About half of the courses are taught by the teachers themselves. And then the other half of the courses, we go about the business of finding the right experts to teach those courses. And so very often, you know, there's about several hundred universities in New York City, and we tap them and have strong relationships with them. So many of our courses are taught by mathematicians or scientists from local universities. We also bring in folks from around the country often. And so we go about the business of building this catalog. And then the teachers, at each semester, they get an opportunity to enroll in courses that they want to take. Conversations for another time is we have this great problem of it's like rushing to buy concert tickets often to enroll in courses. And we intentionally keep our classes really small. So a typical course for us has 15 teachers in it. You can intuit why. I won't go into the science of that. But so all of our teachers enroll in courses, only courses that they want to take. There's no required courses they need to take. There's nothing. There's no requirements at all around any of this. And so they all enroll in courses for a semester. And then those teachers who are teaching courses either come to us with the facility of teaching and they've said, I have lots of experience teaching other teachers, or they don't. And if they don't, we provide courses for the facilitators to learn how to teach the courses, if that makes sense. So every semester, there's about 200 courses that happen. Those courses are usually 3 to 4 workshops combined together, makes one course, so they generally meet monthly. Our offices are located in a very geographical sort of central place in Manhattan, so the teachers come to our offices for courses. Our offices are quite large, and we have 7 to 10 classrooms here. Not school classrooms, it's don't have that as a mental model, but they look like conference room type environments. But the teachers all come here for those courses. Our courses are always in the evening, so the teachers never have to leave school or get a sub or worry about coverage. As you know, that's always a challenge. We always feed them every night when they come. There's always pizza. And they're 5 nights a week, and teachers can choose courses that fit in with their personal lives as much as choose courses that pique their curiosity. So like I said, I can say a lot more about that, but that's sort of how the teachers are involved, which I think was your original question.
Yes, that's awesome. I'm just trying to get a grasp of this because you actually answered one of my questions. I was wondering where the classes were, where they had to come to take the classes, if they were offered in their schools or if they were in a central location type thing where they all came to. And that's fantastic. And you know, one of the things that what you get me thinking about here is that, because that's the type of professional interaction there that's got to take place must be amazing.
It's pretty jaw dropping.
It's got to be, because I mean, first of all, they had to go through an application process to get accepted into it, and then so you put people and together who've been accepted into a program and they're talking professionally and getting excited about what they're learning and because they've had possibly some hand in selecting what they're learning. And then, you know, and they see the matter in which they could help the kids, you know, use this to achieve whatever it is they're trying to achieve. Oh my gosh.
I get
the hair.
But there's two things about that I think are really important. One is it's a 4-year fellowship. Uh-huh. And that fellowship's actually, they can apply for a second fellowship, and I would argue they can actually even apply for a third fellowship. So just to give you a sense of time, these aren't teachers who go to, let's call it an amazing 3-day PD program. That's not what this is, right? This is teachers who develop very long relationships with each other over time, who become part of their professional community and livelihood. So you can enter into that community with a very different lens if you know you're going to be spending time with people over years, not days. So that's one piece of the power. The other thing is, and I say this knowing the controversy that surrounds it, is sometimes, and don't take this the wrong way, sometimes what they learn here has nothing to do with their kids. And we could not be happier about that. We think strongly that what makes great teachers continue to want to stay in the classroom is that they are professionally curious and satisfied and feel professional. And so sometimes the courses that teachers take are just what I like to call intellectual candy. That keep them at the forefront of their craft, that keep them, you know, science teachers need to talk about science, right? They don't always need to talk about science teaching. Mathematics teachers need to talk about mathematics. They don't always need to talk about mathematics teaching. So if you peruse our catalog, you'll see a lot of courses that you might furrow your brow and say, gosh, are kids learning about this in high school? And the answer might be no. it very often is yes. But my point is that what we do here is we want to help teachers incentivize, we want to incentivize teachers to feel really good about their craft and to feel professional and to feel like experts. And so part of that puzzle is creating the opportunities for them to just continue learning, regardless sometimes of whether that learning is clearly correlated with their students.
I got to say this. I love what you're talking about because you're so right. I mean, part of the profession is that, you know, for someone who gets into the profession for the wrong reasons, for whatever reason they got into it, it's out there anyway. But someone who is an educator, they should have this gene in them that makes them get geeky all over their content and the stuff that's part of their content and learning more. And, you know, the idea that I didn't know this. And so as I find out more and I delve into it, and, you know, in the back of your mind, you might be thinking how I might bring it in the classroom, but it doesn't have to be that. It's that type of thing where you're being engaged and you're excited about that engagement. And I hear that right now. And this would be so cool because those types of conversations, you know, it's part of the thing that when you're working on upper level degrees, as I'm sure you experienced, one of the things that happens is that when you get into those conversations with people that, you know, only it sounds like a joke or something I'm about to say, but only two history majors who have a focus on, the revolutionary period in, you know, upper state New York might get geeky about the one thing where, you know, as opposed to you add somebody else in that conversation, they're going, what are you guys so excited about here? You know,
it's like, yeah,
no, go away, you don't understand.
And I think that's right. And I think, you know, metaphorically, you and I have both been in teachers' lounges before, right?
Yes.
Sort of, we know what those look like. And wouldn't it be great if in the teachers' lounges, instead of talking always about whatever, you know, you could talk about lesson plans, you could talk about complaining about things, hopefully you're not, but we know that those things happen. We want to create an environment where teachers want to talk about things of intellectual interest in the teacher's lounge. And it changes the way the profession exists if the professionals themselves have different discourse or, you know, want to talk about their craft just for the pleasure of talking about their craft. And part of doing that is feeling like you have something to say.
That's so on mark there. You know, it's funny. I was in a one of my upper level history programs, and we were in a class where when you get up to that level of history, you know, you have lots of kids that are only kids. Listen to me. I wasn't a kid then. you have lots of the students who are taking the classes are all typically either professionals or they're full-time students. But for the most part, you can end up having conversations about stuff, but you still get into the mindset that you have to write down what the professor says, everything they say, because they don't want to know what you think. Well, when you take that rare person who really wants to know what you think, it's kind of, and I have this in the back of my mind, this memory of the professor going, I just said the most controversial thing and you guys just wrote it down and I want to talk about this. And that I want to talk about this is that part that I want to get to, because it sounds like you could have that. If you're a member of this, you could have that ability to say, you know, this is something I've wanted to talk about. You know, why is it this way? Or it could it be that if we adjusted it or added this variable, or if we added a little bit of heat here, we're talking science experiment, I don't know. You know, what would happen here? What do you think about that? That type of thing.
And
that's such a cool interaction for educators, because that does inspire you when you have those conversations. Because, yeah, like you said, what used to be the teacher's lounge is not exactly not known for its professional interactions.
Yeah. Well, I just use that for proxy for the way teachers talk, you know?
Right. Understand. So cool stuff. I love that, how that all, what it's focused on, because I can just hear it now. I've had the good fortune of being involved in discussions like that in schools where we were focused on trying to create engaging lessons and such, and having professional just at, just that type of discussion, it's such at a higher level that it really, you know, the best word I got is just you kind of geek out on this type of stuff. And it just is a neat feeling when that happens. So you're encouraging that, which I think is so cool. So what I'd like to do now is one of the things I kind of like to get you to talk about is that I've heard you mention in a talk that as educators, we need to talk differently about our profession. Can you expand upon that just a little bit?
Sure. We do, right? I mean, I think teachers are their own worst enemies sometimes when they talk down about the profession. I think that, and it sort of, you know, it just goes back to what we were just saying. I think if teachers feel more efficacious or, you know, if teachers feel more confident in what they do and they feel more professional, they'll talk differently about their profession. I don't think we're there yet. I think that we need to encourage a conversation where teachers talk differently about and are incentivized to talk differently about their profession, that they are not in a cocktail party environment where they apologize for being a teacher or they suggest that they're only a teacher until X, Y, and Z, that they don't try to or aren't asked to be martyrs or aren't asked to, you know, define or provide context for why they're teachers. I think that that's the culture that we live in. I do think it's changing somewhat, but I think we're not there yet. So I think teachers need to be incentivized and it needs to be modeled for them how to talk differently about their profession so that other people will start to talk differently about their profession. I mean, I could say a lot more about that, but I think it's, you know, it's not, we're not there yet. You know, I don't know if you read this thing in the press this week, but these Time magazine articles that came out a couple weeks ago had all these different covers of all these different teachers, and the byline said things like, you know, I've been teaching for, I don't know if I'll get it right, so don't quote me on this, but something like, I've been a teacher for 16 years and I can't pay for X, Y, and Z or something. And I think 3 years ago or 4 years ago, Time had a very different spin on teachers and had a cover about sort of bad teachers need to go. And I think the headline that I read yesterday was going from, you know, being a bad teacher to becoming a martyr. And this idea that there's now this public discourse where teachers are martyrs. And I don't think they're martyrs. I don't think they want to be thought of as martyrs. I think they're professionals, man. I think that we haven't yet landed as a country on how to talk about them universally in the same way we talk about so many other professions. There's a common understanding of what it means when we say college professor. There's a common understanding of what we mean as a country when we say technology coordinator, or when we say doctor, or when we say businessman, but there's not a commonly held definition of what we mean when we say teacher. And I think that there's many of us across the country, and you're included, who are trying to create some common language and some common definitions around teacher. And I think the teachers have to be part of that defining as well.
I love it. And I love your passion about this. This is, you know, you're so right. And it's something that, you just see it all the time. You see things happen where you have a conversation with somebody, or you're at a conversation and they're asking each other what they do. And the the comment is kind of almost like apologetically saying that they're a teacher. And it's like, no, what are you doing? I'm a teacher, man. This is cool stuff. I get to work with kids. I mean, how many adults in this country that are not in education have the good fortune of going to a meeting? At the meeting, you find, you know, someone taps you on the shoulder and says, are you Mr. Mileto, the same Mr. Mileto who taught history at such and such school? And you go, yeah. And you start looking, you're listening to that voice, and all of a sudden you see the 16-year-old standing in front of you who's now 40, you know, and you're going, oh my gosh. And to have a conversation like that and to hear about what they've done, you know, that's, oh man, we help shape lives. We help shape futures and help them achieve their dreams. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that's so cool about it. And I just love that conversation, because I agree with you. We got to change that teacher talk about the profession. It's good stuff. So one of the things I'd like to do is that I'd like to shift now to this, because you can't help but throughout everything on the website about Math for America, there's this constant talk about encouraging the development of similar organizations in other states. What would it take for a teacher to try and get the MFA model happening in their hometown or their state?
Yeah, it's doable. I mean, I think part of our mission is to spread our fellowship models by helping others create their own independent programs that are based on the same principles as ours and tailor those programs to meet their own geographical needs. So we certainly have a belief and a whole line of support that we want to provide to help others build a model. I think we don't put money into those programs, but we certainly advise, and we don't charge for anything at all. We don't want any money. We don't want any ownership. But we'll help anybody from the earliest design stages until their program is up and running successfully if they can figure out their money situation locally. We've helped tons of nonprofits start small, privately funded programs. Some of those are based in universities in various cities across the country. But we're trying to take our sort of internal model, or some would say our innovative model, of how we encourage teachers to think about their craft and push it out so that other people can learn from it. We helped, I don't know if you saw this on our website, but we helped New York State at large build an MFA program across the street that's actually publicly funded. It's housed in the State University of New York. It's quite successful, and it keeps expanding every year. You know, I think the biggest obstacle for anyone is money. We're happy to help with any of that and all of that. I think, you know, I don't know that I see an – look, I think teachers can do anything. So if your question is how can an individual teacher help get an MFA program started, I would say get a lot of individual teachers together to talk to their local, whether it's district or, you know, state level, and get momentum, as anything should be, get momentum behind it, and they can reach out to us, and we can certainly do everything we can, without the checkbook at least, to help them, give them all of the resources, all of our guidelines, all of our work. We have no interest in keeping it sole proprietary at all. They can reach out to us and we can help with that. And it's happening now. I mean, it happens. There's MFAs across the country. There are, like I was just saying a minute ago, there's a few universities who are building our model from within their university. And so it's expanding. But I think for us, the most important thing is this idea of creating communities where teachers, experienced teachers, learn from other experienced teachers in ways that amplify professionalism and in ways that can have an impact on other teachers.
Awesome. Awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. And if someone wanted to connect further with you or learn more about MFA, where would you send them?
I would say they could certainly go to our website. We have all the contact information that you need on our website, and we are quite good at quick response at times and making sure that we get people's queries to the right folks. So I think our website has all the information they would need. They should also watch some of our videos if they want inspiration. We're also quite active on social media, Facebook and Twitter. We also just launched our Instagram work, so it's not hard to find us at all.
Excellent. And I'll put links to the social media as well as the website on my show notes. So for those of you listening, you just need to go to the show notes and they'll be right there. One of the things that I want to do is I got last two questions as we get ready to close. And they go like this. If you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers who haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them?
I would tell them not to try to write their own curriculum. I would. I can say a lot more about that, but I think too many new teachers are either being asked to or required to or feel the need to write their own curriculum, and I don't think that's where they should put their energy. I think that the best curriculum to me is school-based curriculum, where the school has common foundations of curriculum for all kids, and I think that first-year teachers, so these pre-teachers, if you will, if they're brand new, should focus on their craft of pedagogy and should focus on their craft of learning how to support kids. And I don't think it's in their best interest in their first year to try to write their own curriculum. I think they'll become better curriculum writers after they have more experience in the classroom.
That's an awesome response. I have not had that one. I love that. That is so cool. Just, you know, stay focused on your craft. Excellent message. So last question. Do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If given a chance to say thank you, who would it be and what would you say?
That's so nice of you to say. I think my fifth grade teacher was named Rocco Dotto. I swear that's his name. Hi,
awesome,
Mr. Dotto, if you're listening. He was amazing. He was like 6'100". And he always held chalk in his hands that he would constantly toss up in the air while he was talking to us, if you can get a mental model of that. And I think he made a huge difference in my life because I remember I was what am I in fifth grade? I'm 10, I think. And I remember vividly for the first time, and maybe I wasn't ready for it earlier, but he talked to me like an adult. He talked to me just like a person. And I remember remembering that, you know, that was a very pivotal moment for me in school because I felt for the first time like what I said mattered and it wasn't scripted and he wasn't talking down to me. And I can remember fifth grade. I can remember almost so many days of fifth grade and I can remember the conversations that I was allowed to have with him and the conversations that he had with me, whether it was in large group work, small group work, or just individually. I remember him thinking that my mind mattered. And thank you, Mr. Dotto, that has stayed with me for, let's call it over 30 years and leave it at that.
That is so awesome. Because that, you know, that's one of those things where I think the teachers who make a difference, they recognize that the kids have thoughts and ideas and they want to express that. But too many of adults want to say, you know, shut up, kid. You bother me. Get away. You know?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, or they don't know what to do with your questions, you know?
Yeah, that too. Thank you so much for sharing it. Well, Megan, thank you so much for sharing Math for America with us. I love the focus on excellence and trust. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I wish you the very best.
Thanks, Steve. I enjoyed it as well.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and hosts. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.